Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment affiliate. You can find us on social media at The Turning Tides Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Twitter. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Warning, this episode of Turning Tides contains depictions of war, violence, suicide, sexual assault, rape, enslavement, and drug usage.
It was early January 2024. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi was opening a new Hindu temple dedicated to the god Ram in the state of Uttar Pradesh. This had been a dream of the Hindu Nationalist Party for decades. The site of this new Hindu temple was once the location of a great mosque, the Babri Masjid. This mosque had stood for hundreds of years. In 1992, it was ransacked and literally ripped apart by an angry mob of Hindu nationalists intent on destroying the holy building, which they claimed celebrated a tyrant. This mosque, they said, was named after the founder of the Mughal Empire, Babur, the tiger. In the ensuing upheaval, upwards of 2,000, mostly Muslim Indians, were butchered in the Bombay riots. This was not the first instance of sectarian violence in the Indian subcontinent, and it would not be the last. In order to understand the animosity and hate which permeates many spheres of modern-day India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, we need to first go back in time and understand how Babur came to found an empire, how that empire thrived, declined, and then died violently over the course of nearly 300 years. In a previous series, we discussed the rise of the Timurids under their bloodthirsty leader, Emir Timur, or Tamerlane. Following his death at the gates of China, his core empire continued to thrive throughout Central Asia. His progeny, in fact, oversaw a renaissance in the arts, sciences, and literature, which greatly inspired neighboring societies, such as Persia and the Ottoman state. This renaissance would not last, however. The Timurid princes and kings were in the process of being violently supplanted by the Uzbek tribe. Babur, or Zahir ud-Din Muhammad, was born around this time in Farhana, in present-day Uzbekistan. He came to power at the age of 12 following the death of his father in 1494. Alongside his mother and grandmother, Babur's following began to grow to such an extent that he was able to threaten and eventually capture the city of Samarkand in 1496. His mother and grandmother would set the tone for strong matriarchal roles within the Mughal state. Additionally, Babur's sister, Kanzara, was with him throughout all of his campaigns and many reverses. In time, she would make a dear sacrifice for her younger brother. In 1500, Babur would marry for the first time when he was 17. He made a point to explain that this was a political marriage, and any physical attraction experienced between the two faded quickly with the death of their newborn. Babur took much more interest in a young man who acted as a camp follower in his retinue. He was so attracted to this young man that he had to physically look away when he was in his presence. Babur was so smitten that he describes wandering through the forests and mountains, quote, like the madman, unquote. He finally concludes his feelings by writing in Turkish verse, quote, nor power to go was mine, nor power to stay. I was just what you made me, O thief of my heart. Unquote. Within months of Babur's ascension, the Uzbeks were at the gates of Samarkand, attempting to supplant him. Of all his enemies, Babur detested the Uzbeks the most. He wrote of them with clear derision, quote, "For nearly 140 years, the capital of Samarkand has been in our family. Then came the Uzbeks, the foreign foe from God knows where, and took over." Unquote. Babur was counting on reinforcements from his uncles and subjects, but none arrived to aid him. Babur seemed destined to be little more than an obscure footnote in Central Asian history, but his elder sister stepped up to save her sibling's life. Kanzada offered herself as a wife to the invading Uzbek chief. In return, the chief had to promise Babur and his followers safe passage. This was begrudgingly accepted. It deeply upset Babur. He refused to ever mention the real reason he was allowed to leave Samarkand alive. Following the death of the Uzbek leader, Kanzada made her way back to Babur, where she was celebrated and reunited with her brother. She would come to be called the Padshah Begum, or First Lady of the Empire. Similarly to their Mongol predecessors, Babur and his followers recognized how important women were in holding the empire together. They bore no ill will toward women who remarried, whether or not they had been taken as brides by the enemy. Babur also began the practice of granting women land. This allowed for some royal women to become incredibly wealthy. Babur soon found himself in a similar position to his great ancestor, Emir Timur. He was forced into the wilderness, without title or home. Babur traveled this way for years, being constantly harried by the Uzbeks. Eventually, he gained control over the present-day Afghan capital of Kabul. For over 20 years, Babur would call Kabul home, and today it is his final resting place. During this time, he made his first forays into the Indian subcontinent, which was then called Hindustan, or the land of the Hindus. Babur began equipping his armies with gunpowder and cannon units. Unfortunately, Babur's autobiography neglects to reflect on these crucial years, which are missing from the account altogether. In 1508, Babur would have a son, Humayun, named after a mythical bird from Iranian mythology. In 1519, he would have a second son named Hindal, which translated into "Take India." It was clear Babur had shifted his focus from regaining the ancestral Timurid birthplace of Central Asia to conquering an entirely new realm altogether. The same year Hindal was born, the fortress of Bajaur in modern-day Pakistan capitulated to Babur's besieging army. By 1525, Babur had assembled a host 25,000 strong, intent on invading and claiming India for himself. He intended on using the instability of the Delhi Sultanate to his advantage, in order to defeat his enemies in turn. Babur traveled along the same route of invasion which Timur and Alexander the Great used for their expeditions into the Indian subcontinent. Reading Babur's autobiography, one can't help but notice the similarities between his invasion of India and the Spanish invasion of the Aztec or Incan empires. Babur called India a, quote, "new world," unquote, and was constantly awestruck by the diverse animals and greenery he discovered on his campaigns. He constantly refers to what he considers the, quote-unquote, backwardness and ugliness of India and Indians. Additionally, he looked back fondly on his conquests, describing the land as quote-unquote empty before his family's arrival, which is a classic motif in almost all settler colonial projects. Finally, his conquests were justified as holy wars, since most of his opponents followed different religions. He was seemingly committed to his faith. He instituted the jizya tax against non-Muslims. He desecrated, quote-unquote, profane Jain temples. And he proclaimed himself a Ghazi, or a fighter for the faith. He wrote, quote, "For the sake of Islam, I became a vagabond. I fought with the Hindus and with many heathens. I was ready to die as a martyr, but thanks to God, I became a hero of the faith." Unquote. Arrayed against Babur and his small but elite army were as many as 100,000 warriors and upwards of 1,000 war elephants of the Delhi Sultanate. This North Indian state had seen better days. The country was in the middle of a disastrous and bloody civil war. Babur was seemingly at a disadvantage, but he had several major factors working in his favor. The first was his team of Persian and Ottoman advisors who had introduced matchlock muskets and pre-modern artillery into Babur's army. Another advantage for the invaders was their superior knowledge of military tactics. After years of trial and error, Babur had refined his art of war into a precise science. He implemented quote-unquote Roman techniques, which utilized dug-in entrenchments and wagon loggers. These were wagons, armed with cannon and then latched together, which created a near-impenetrable wall against enemy cavalry charges. Andrew de la Garza says that in this system, defensive entrenchments were key, and quote, "the shovel was nearly as important as the musket," unquote. This turned Babur's armies into relatively mobile forts, which could swiftly deploy for a rapid defense. Finally, what set Babur's armies apart from others was his ability to combine these Roman defensive tactics with his cavalry advantage. This gave Babur an incredibly strong center, with infantry arrayed in three separate formations, the vanguard, the center, or the reserve. Meanwhile, Babur's flanks were secured by elite horse archers and shock cavalry units from Central Asia. This combined strategy of Asian and European warfare would influence the entirety of the Indian subcontinent until the early colonial period. The First Battle of Panipat would demonstrate this clearly. Babur had been harassing and skirmishing with Sultan Ibrahim's men all through April of 1526. They were trying to goad him into attacking their fortified wagon camp. Babur had chosen a magnificent spot to defend. One of his flanks was protected by a huge river, and he had his center protected by 700 different interlocking wagons. On April 20th, Sultan Ibrahim and his 100,000 lost their patience and launched a full-on frontal assault all along Babur's line. Babur may have had only 10,000 men on hand. The rest of his army was spread throughout the width of modern-day northwest India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. Leading the charge for Ibrahim were his massive war elephants. These elephants proved perfect targets for Babur's matchlock men and his artillery. Many of the animals, alongside their crews, were killed in this initial charge. Ibrahim's cavalry followed close behind and became bogged down amongst the wagons and the corpses of pachyderms. Those in front attempted to retreat, while those behind attempted to surge forward. This created a quagmire of living and dead elephants, horses, and human bodies, who were constantly being picked off by Babur's small arms and mortar fire. It was at this crucial moment that Babur unleashed his own cavalry at the flanks of Ibrahim's unwieldy army. Very rapidly, the men in the middle of this maw retreated. The battle was now a full-blown massacre. 15,000 men alongside Sultan Ibrahim lay dead on the field by the end of the day. Babur established himself in Agra as the new king of Hindustan. But just as quickly as his reign began, a Rajput confederation under their leader Rana Sanga declared war on Babur, and another army of 100,000 was threatening Agra. Babur would take the field once more, determined to crush this native threat to his newly won Indian crown. Once more, he would rely on his encampments and mobile Roman-style forts, while also being able to draw upon greater resources and manpower. In March 1527, the two armies would meet around a canal and settle, once and for all, who would rule the northern half of the Indian subcontinent. Rana Sanga, the Maharana of Mewar, had a great advantage in numbers, and also had the legendary Rajput cavalry. They fought using tactics similar to that of European knights. They also had longbowmen, who fired arrows using bows, which resembled their English counterparts in many respects. Sanga's army was far superior to that of Sultan Ibrahim's. He believed he could push through Babur's center with a determined charge, leaving the would-be emperor with his flanks in the air. Coming upon the mounted and armed wagon trains, the Rajputs soon realized how foolish this proposition was. Babur writes, quote, "When the battle had raged for a long time, an order was issued that the warriors, who were like lions in chains, charged from behind the caissons and spilled the dawn-red blood of the hapless infidels. The royal matchlock men left the caissons for the midst of battle, and each one of them gave the poison of death to taste." Unquote. As the infantry surged forward and pinned the Rajputs in place, Babur's cavalry swarmed the flanks. This proved too much even for the battle-hardened Rajputs. They broke and another general slaughter commenced. Above all, the branch of service which decided this battle for Babur was his artillery. They devastated numerous enemies and killed countless elephants. Rana Sanga attempted to form a new army, but he was poisoned by his own nobleman in 1528. This ended any determined resistance to Babur's new rule. Babur had just shown everyone living in the Indian subcontinent that he was the greatest warrior of his day. He also proved the efficacy of combining Western and Eastern military traditions into a near unstoppable force. Now that all of his enemies lay defeated and killed at his feet, Babur felt comfortable enough to invite the royal harem to India. He did this in a grisly way, sending the severed heads of rebels and quote-unquote infidels to his many wives. Throughout Babur's invasion, he doled out punishment to any rebellious subjects. He made numerous pyramids of human skulls in quote-unquote honor of his ancestor Timur, and used his matchlock men as pre-modern firing squads. The level of punishment and torture would only increase as Mughal rule spread. On the whole, however, Babur made a point to not punish civilians, wishing to ingratiate himself with his new subjects. Babur turned away from his raucous adventurer lifestyle in favor of ruling over the people. There was no more infamous drinking parties or day-long consumption of a majun, which was a dried fruit with trace amounts of opium. Now, Babur committed himself to his family and to securing the throne for Humayun. If he were alive today, he would likely be frustrated that his empire was named after the Mughals. This was a small tribe on the borderlands of Babur's original kingdom and he considered them disloyal at best and treacherous at worst. This was also the rough native Indian translation of Mongols. In reality, Anne-Marie Schimmel attests that all quote-unquote Mughal emperors referred to themselves as Timurids, or Gurkhani, which means in-laws of the great Khan, a reference to Emir Timur and his relation through marriage to Genghis Khan. During his brief reign, he endeavored to introduce uniformity to an empire which spread the width of the subcontinent, from the rainforest and tributaries of Bengal to the rugged deserts of Rajasthan. Unfortunately, he had barely 3 years left to live, and enemies masquerading as friends were conspiring against the emperor and his sons. In mid-1530, Humayun, Babur's chosen successor and first son, fell gravely ill. Mughal court historians contend that Babur offered his own life in exchange for his sons. He did this during a ritual known as the Magic Circle. Very rapidly, Humayun recovered, while, very rapidly, Babur fell deathly ill. In reality, historians like Ira Makoti speculate that Babur might have been poisoned by a deceitful vassal. Additionally, Babur was ill already. He mentions numerous times in his autobiography that he had to cease campaigning for days and weeks on end because he was, quote, vomiting and excreting blood, unquote. Humayun would become the second Padshah of the nascent empire. He was an enigma, unfairly persecuted by many historians, who damn him for not being as great as his son Akbar or as talented militarily as his father Babur. In reality, Humayun went on a tireless quest to reforge his father's empire. And for the most part, he succeeded. Above all, however, Humayun was a mystic. His worship of astrology and the stars was intense, to say the least. For example, he had his office sectioned off 12 separate ways to correspond to the astrological signs. If you were a Leo, you had to sit in your corresponding section. Besides this, he had stargazers and astrologers beside him at all times, and they often decided when battles were waged or when retreats were initiated. This was not an effective stratagem for winning wars, and numerous defeats befell his forces in the coming civil conflicts. After taking power, Humayun had to deal with rebellions almost immediately. Besides the conspiracies and intrigues of his ever-recalcitrant brothers, his main nemesis ended up being Sher Shah Suri, an elderly Pashtun who was also a genius general and administrator. At this point, virtually all North Indian states had adopted Babur's Roman tactics of war. They added their own refinements, including rocket artillery, as well as camel-mounted and elephant-mounted artillery, to create a battlefield which was dangerously filled with any number of projectiles and required loose formations of infantry as opposed to the tight formations utilized in Europe. Guns and artillery began to play an even more important role in engagements. The dozens of artillery pieces Babur fielded were replaced with thousands on either side of a battle during Humayun's reign. Eventually, field battles proved so costly to the Mughals that they preferred drawn-out sieges or diplomacy. Using his base of operations in Bihar, Sher Shah Suri declared a rebellion against Humayun. For months in 1539, two armies faced each other from across the Karamanasa River. Under the false flag of truce, Sher Shah waited for the perfect moment to strike at Humayun. It came with the rains. Ira Makoti says, quote, "They, the Mughal army, have camped on low ground between the Ganga and the Karamanasa, which is immediately flooded, having waited for the exact moment, and with ferocious precision, Shere Khan conducts a three-pronged attack against the Mughals and is instantaneous and devastating, unquote. It was an absolute rout, which occurred so quickly that there was no time to answer the enemy's assault. 8,000 Mughals were killed, many of them being drowned in the rivers. Besides the soldiers who died, several members of the Mughal harem drowned in the mayhem. Amongst them was Humayun's young daughter, Akika. Humayun writes, quote, "I have been consumed by 100,000 regrets. Why did I take her with the army?" Unquote. Humayun barely escaped with his own life, and his horse drowned attempting to swim through the swollen rivers. When he fell back to Agra, Humayun's brother, Hindal, took up arms against him as well, going as far as to have the khutbah, or the daily prayer to the ruler, read in his own name. Besides Hindal, Humayun's other half-brother, Kamran, was an even greater nuisance. From his far-off fiefdoms of Kabul and Kandahar, he declared numerous rebellions against his older brother, each one failing more spectacularly than the last, until he was eventually blinded and exiled to Mecca. Unable to halt the Suri advance, Humayun fell back to Lahore, where he was reunited with all his brothers, including Askari, who launched numerous rebellions against his elder brother as well. Besides Humayun's obsession with astrology, the second Padsha was by all accounts a kind man, who preferred to rule through the use of the carrot as opposed to the stick. He did this almost to a fault, allowing numerous rebellions and conspiracies to go unpunished, especially when it came to his brothers. Once on the campaign trail, an enemy deserter stumbled into camp. Humayun's officers wanted to have the man tortured to reveal any information he had, but Humayun would not allow it. He said, quote, "Since the man has come to me of his own free will, it would not be magnanimous to use force against him. If success can be achieved by means of kindness, why use harsh measures? Order a banquet to be prepared. Ply the man with wine, and ask him where the treasure is hidden." Unquote. In northern India, Sher Shah was laying the groundwork for a strong central government, and many aspects of his Suri empire would be grafted onto the Mughal state once Humayun reforged the nation. Sher Shah accomplished all of this towards the end of his long life. He would relentlessly persecute the religious sect of the Madawi, and during a siege of one of their fortresses, a cannon backfired and mortally wounded the elderly emperor. Humayun was living as a wanderer after unsuccessfully attempting to take Sichuan. The one bright spot for him was the birth of his son Akbar to his 15-year-old wife Hamida. Their troop traveled to Afghanistan, and after losing once more to Sher Shah, Humayun fell back to Kabul, where his rebellious brothers Kamran and Askari were waiting for him. Beset on all sides, Humayun, a small group of followers, and his wife Hamida fled the country, bound for Persia, where Humayun intended on calling for aid from the Shia Sultan presiding there. Left behind in haste was the infant Akbar, and for years he would be raised by wet nurses and other members of the harem, who were also left behind. Finally arriving in Persia, Humayun traveled to several holy sites across the land. At the mausoleum of Sufi mystic Ahmadi Jam, Humayun had the following verse carved in stone. Quote, "O thou whose mercy accepts the soul of all, the mind of everyone is exposed to thy majesty. The threshold of the gate is the Qibla of the people. Thy bounty with a glance supports everyone. Muhammad Humayun, the wanderer in the desert of destruction." Unquote. After arriving at Sultan Tamasp's court, he used guile and diplomacy to placate the increasingly irrational, ultra-orthodox Shia Sultan. While at court, Humayun was confronted on numerous occasions by the Sultan. He was attempting to convert Humayun to Shiaism. There is debate about the supposed conversion, with some implying the conversion happened, while others claim it was respectfully declined. Either way, in order to save himself, Humayun adorned the traditional headdress of the Shia and was granted his life and 14,000 elite Persian horsemen. Arriving in 1544 with his men, Humayun launched a full-scale invasion of western Afghanistan. His brother, Kamran, had the young Akbar transferred to Kabul, where he was finally able to meet his great-aunt, Khanzada. She kissed the boy's hands and feet, saying, quote, "They are the very hands and feet of my brother, the Emperor Babur, and he is like him altogether," unquote. Finally able to capture Kabul, Akbar was reunited with his mother in a scene which is depicted in countless works of Mughal art. However, Humayun would fall ill, and during his slow recovery, his vassals and brothers rose in rebellion once again. Once more, Akbar was taken prisoner by Kamran in Kabul. Confronted by Humayun's army, Kamran put young Akbar on the battlements, enticing his brother to fire on his own son. Humayun thankfully refused to fire, but the siege did not cease until 1547, when Kamran escaped one night, dressed in traditionally female clothing. He fled to the court of the Suri Empire, now governed by Sher Shah's children. Using Kabul as his base of operations, Humayun, like his father, bided his time to strike and devoted much of his time to the arts. Around the same time, there was a mass exodus of incredibly talented artists from Safavid Persia. They were readily welcomed into Humayun's court, and their exploits and artistic methods influenced a whole generation of Mughal painters, who were further influenced by native Indian designs and ecology. On the battlefield, Humayun had learned his lesson, and he left most of his strategic and tactical decisions to his general and faithful friend, Bairam Khan. In the ensuing campaigns, Bairam Khan won numerous victories against the Suri Empire, causing its rapid decline. Once more, the Mughals owned most of northern India. Humayun, alongside his soldiers, generals, and vassals, had accomplished the impossible for a second time. He named Delhi as his new capital and took the ancient Purana Kila castle as his personal palace. From here, he studied the stars from atop a massive tower on a nearly daily basis. On one such stargazing outing in 1557, the call for evening prayers was made from the many mosques. Humayun was determined to be present, and he rushed down the spiral stairs in a haste. At some point, he tripped and fell all the way to the base of the stairs, mortally wounded. In the interim, something had to be done in order to prevent a succession crisis. A man who looked similar to Humayun was disguised as the dead emperor and masqueraded as him for several days. This gave Akbar enough time to assume control of the country, with Bairam Khan as his chief regent. Akbar would become the third Padshah when he was only 14. Remembered as the Great, Akbar was seen as the most judicious, fair, and open-minded ruler that the Mughals ever had. G.B. Malson argues that it was Akbar who truly made the Mughal Empire. He says Babur and Humayun were conquerors at the end of the day, while Akbar was altogether different from his father and grandfather. Akbar managed to not only hold the empire together, but shape it into a centralized state with a rigid court structure and legal code. Before he could implement any of his desired reforms, he had to contend with a number of usurpers. Humayun had captured only a part of Babur's original empire. Bengal, for example, still lay in the hands of the Suri dynasty. Their armies were led by Hemu, a Hindu mercenary. Hemu is a truly extraordinary figure in Indian history. He was born a peasant to a commoner family, but he refused to let this stop him. Slowly working up the ranks, he now felt confident enough in his chances against the young Akbar, as well as the husk of the Suri Empire. He cast aside his allegiance to the Suris and proclaimed himself Vikramaditya, or emperor. At the same time, Akbar's uncles were up to their old tricks, stirring up trouble in Afghanistan. Supported by his harem and his ace general, Bairam Khan, Akbar had few other allies. Harems were groups of women who were sometimes as powerful as the emperor and could even decree laws in their own names. Besides wives and concubines, there were adopted sisters, widows of former generals killed in combat, wet nurses, and aunts. This social network of powerful women helped root the Mughal Empire into its new foundation as effectively as any of Akbar's reforms or military victories. Akbar admits the crucial role his wet nurses and aunts played in his upbringing. This made the wet nurses of Akbar and their families incredibly powerful in their own respect. In a famous case, one of the impudent nephews of Akbar's wet nurse killed the prime minister of the country within the royal palace. He assumed that because of his family's strong connection with Akbar, he would be pardoned. Unfortunately for him, Akbar was so furious, he tossed the man from his second-story balcony. When he clung to life, Akbar ordered servants to collect his shattered body and have him thrown from the balcony again, this time killing him. Meanwhile, Hemu was gathering men to his banner at a prodigious rate. Agra had just fallen without a fight. Rather than wait for Hemu's army to attack, Bairam Khan boldly pushed his forces across the Soltej River. Bairam Khan was one of the most impressive generals of the age, and he should be largely credited with defeating numerous enemies for Humayun and Akbar. His main fault, at least in the eyes of Sunni fundamentalists, was that he was a Shia. In time, the Sunni clergy, the harem, Bairam Khan, and Akbar would all vie for power following the war. For now, the army was placed once more around Panipat, where two generations previously, Babur had won an empire through conquest and bloodshed. As the two forces converged on one another, Hemu made a serious tactical mistake. He sent his Turkish artillery forward without support, while his infantry, cavalry, and elephants were busy still marching to the battlefield. Bairam Khan pounced on and destroyed these guns with little effort. This infuriated Hemu, who double-timed his men to assault the enemy. The Second Battle of Panipat is called, quote, "the decisive battle of the century," unquote, by G.B. Malison. Hemu's forces were greatly superior to that of Bairam Khan's. At his front, Hemu had 500 war elephants, determined to break the backs of the Mughal army early. The rest of his army was separated into three divisions. It was October 7, 1556, when the battle truly started. Launching a ferocious attack on the Mughal left, Hemu redeployed himself to the center, where he hoped to pierce the Mughal formation. Instead, a chance arrow pierced his eye, and his panicked war elephant instinctively withdrew to the jungle. Hemu's army, lacking cohesion, broke headlong after the supposed death of their leader. Scouring the forest after the battle, the half-alive Hemu was discovered and thrown at Akbar's feet. Bairam Khan said to Akbar, quote, "Prove your sword on this infidel, for it will be a meritorious deed," unquote. Akbar replied, quote, "He is now no better than a dead man. How can I strike him?" unquote. Bairam Khan took it upon himself to decapitate Hemu. One of the greatest threats to the Mughal Empire had been silenced. paving the way to Delhi, and to Akbar assuming total control over most of the Indian subcontinent. For several years, Akbar set about laying the groundwork for his new centralized state. First, he dealt with numerous court intrigues. Amongst them were assassination attempts, plots of usurpation, and administrative reforms. Akbar, in spite of his scholarly disposition, was illiterate. There are many theories as to why this is, but the most prevailing is that Akbar suffered from intense dyslexia, rendering him incapable of reading. To counter this, he had numerous historians and writers brought in to document the goings-on of court. Amongst them was Galbadan, a daughter of Babur and writer of two biographies detailing Babur and Humayun's lives. In addition to Galbadan, Abdul Fazl was one of Akbar's closest friends as well as a court historian. He also had a servant, usually a eunuch, who read to him by candlelight. He sent Bairam Khan away early, dismissing him officially from his court. Bairam Khan would raise his flag in rebellion, but he made no headway, and he was eventually killed by vengeful Afghans. Akbar took Bairam Khan's widow as his own wife, but this was done in order to provide financial support for the family, and Bairam Khan's son would end up becoming one of the great generals of his own time, remembered as the Khan Kana, or leader of leaders. Militarily, Akbar introduced more advanced and accurate forms of firearms. He is described by Andrew de la Garza as being a, quote, gun nut, unquote, who owned thousands of weapons. His obsession with firearms helped propel the Mughal military into a place where it rivaled and even surpassed the great European armies of the day. Whereas European firearms were built for punching power, the weaponry of the Mughals was built for accuracy. Akbar gradually turned hunting and gunsmithing into a science, as well as an art, in Mughal India. He even named his firearms and had court historians tally how many animals were killed and from which weapon. A single musket is supposedly responsible for killing as many as 6,000 animals. Around 1560, Akbar began his military campaigning once more. His eyes were set upon the kingdom of Malwa and the rich resources therein. Following a decade of bitter fighting, Malwa submitted to Mughal hegemony. Akbar moved on to Rajputana. This was home to fierce warriors who defended their lands, as well as their family's honor, ravenously. This conquest proved much more difficult. An especially tough nut to crack ended up being Chittor. The massive fort held out for months against numerous Mughal advances. Over 20,000 Mughal warriors fell to the determined defenders. When finally the siege ended and the garrison surrendered, Akbar made an example of them. He had all 30,000 butchered and placed their heads on spikes along the roads in Rajputana. All along the campaign route, Rajput women and children were immolating themselves in a practice known as seti. This was done in order to preserve what Ira Makoti called the, quote, sexual honor, unquote, of the fighting men. Akbar's main enemy throughout the Rajputana campaigns ended up being Maharana Pratap. He was the grandson of Rana Sanga, and he believed it was his heavenly duty to battle the Muslim invaders until they were evicted from his country. For decades, Pratap proved to be a thorn in the side of the Mughal authorities, and his example would be followed by Muslim and Hindu rebels in the future. He proved that a highly coordinated and disciplined guerrilla campaign could humble even the Grand Mughal Empire, which could draw upwards of 4 million men to its banners at its height. Using the inhospitable terrain of the Rajasthani desert, as well as a highly disciplined mobile force, Pratap flustered the Mughals repeatedly. In the end, even Pratap could not release the stranglehold the Mughals had on the nation, and following his death, his rebellion petered out. Akbar moved on to Gujarat and then to Bengal, which were two enclaves of Suri power which still remained. Next, he turned west, where he waged constant battle with rebellious Afghan tribes in the mountains and in Central Asia. His ambitions remained unquenched. He annexed the rest of the Indus Valley to his domain, as well as Baluchistan in Central Asia. Finally, he moved south, crossing into the Deccan region. This inhospitable and arid area of southern India was previously home to a powerful southern Hindu state, but has since been supplanted by numerous polities referred to as the Deccani Sultanates. These were essentially Muslim city-states, who had little authority over the largely Hindu populations who lived in the countryside. This decentralized region fell easily to Akbar, but it would prove one of the greatest obstacles to the Mughals in the future. This whole time, Akbar was changing the Mughal state into one that was more tolerant, inquisitive, and industrious. He was a man who was completely fascinated by other faiths and cultures, especially the ones he considered the most, quote-unquote, exotic. He had numerous Hindu and Christian works translated into Persian and Arabic so that they could be easily read at court. He invited holy men from all across the globe to debate theology at his palace. Hindu gurus, Sufi dervishes, and Jesuit priests could be found any given day at Akbar's court, much to the anger of the fundamentalist Sunni clergy. Akbar was probably most fascinated by Hindu sun worship, and this practice became common every morning and night to Akbar and his court. He likely acquired this belief through his Rajput wives, who brought along their religion and culture. The alliances formed between Akbar and the Rajputs proved crucial in winning the loyalty of these fierce warriors. The Rajputs would become an integral part of Mughal power, fashioning almost 60% of the troops for the army by the mid-17th century. In every sense of the phrase, Akbar was an enlightened despot. Besides advancing open debate amongst his subjects, he was an advocate of religious liberty. He abolished the arbitrary and hated jizya tax against non-Muslims, as well as financial duties which were imposed against Hindus who were on pilgrimage to their own holy places. He finely tuned the workings of the court and started the Mansabdari system, which appointed regional governors who were loyal to Akbar and helped to administer his massive realm at the local level. There was also much debate around Akbar and his religious beliefs. Some scholars even claim he started his own religion, or cult, called the Din-i-Ilahi, based around the worship of himself as a divine being. In spite of his enlightened despotism, Akbar had a clear penchant for violence and cruelty. Besides the atrocities he committed during wars, he once tortured a man for 5 days by throwing him to a trained elephant before releasing him. In an even more horrifying case, he had a group of orphaned newborns segregated from humanity. He wished to know what would happen if the children experienced no contact with their nurses and were not spoken to. This horrifying human experiment, unsurprisingly, ended with all the children suffering debilitating learning disabilities. He also tamed and housed thousands of animals who presided in the royal stables. Akbar took personal interest in the welfare of these animals and is largely credited by his court historian Abdul Fazl with training all the royal hunting cheetahs. Meanwhile, Akbar also greatly expanded the architectural heritage of the burgeoning Mughal state. His most enduring accomplishment was the design and construction of an entirely new capital city called Fatehpur Sikri. It was here that the harem now lived and studied. They were protected by 1,000 female warriors, consisting of 500 Central Asian archers and 500 Ethiopian musketeers. Besides these personal bodyguards, There was a legion of court eunuchs and middlemen who set up strong social barriers between the harem and the outside world. In spite of this, women continued to play a crucial role in Mughal society. This was especially true of sex workers, who were subsidized by the state and could even become extremely powerful at court in their own regard. Abortion and birth control were commonplace for royal as well as common women, and Akbar made a point to ban involuntary immolation of women. He found it strange that women should die for the honor of their husbands. However, many women still voluntarily threw themselves on their husbands' pyres. At the funeral of one of Akbar's top Hindu generals, Man Singh, over 60 women voluntarily cast themselves into the flames. Akbar helped to revolutionize the Indian economy, turning textiles and rugs from India into world-class goods, sold as far away as England. The finery in Mughal rug making and design was matched only in the stunning fabrics woven in numerous Indian textile mills. Contrary to popular belief, India prior to British colonization was a highly mechanized and industrialized society. Much like with firearm design, however, Mughal rulers and bosses preferred quality over quantity. One of the most stunning examples of this is in the fabric, the Dara Masleen, which has never been successfully duplicated to this day and is regarded as one of the most intricate, high thread count fabrics ever created. Besides this, the Mughals controlled a third of the world's economy at their height, and the riches of India left Europeans eternally salivating. Counting up the personal wealth of Akbar near the end of his reign, a Flemish merchant claimed that his gemstones and diamonds alone were worth 60 million rupees. European traders and merchants had been in the subcontinent since before Babur's invasion. These were mostly Portuguese colonizers and adventurers. They were initially led by Alfonso de Albuquerque, the same man who led the first Portuguese forays into Southeast Asia, discussed in our series on Singapore's early settlements. Until it was too late, almost all Mughal leaders believed the Europeans were not a threat to the empire in the slightest. In hindsight, this proved one of the great failures of Mughal India. They were too preoccupied with what was happening in India as opposed to what was happening in the outside world. They felt secure geographically, and besides a handful of guerrillas, the Mughals did not have a serious rival in the region. Additionally, the Portuguese were more interested in maintaining small trade, quote-unquote, factories, as opposed to conquering vast tracts of Indian land. This trend would continue with the Dutch, who were also more interested in naval bases and trade. When the French and the British arrived, however, this mercantile relationship would cease altogether. In the eternal struggle between the two countries, India would be a casualty, to say the least. In the meantime, Akbar received numerous entreaties from European courts. They were all required to bring lavish gifts to all members of the Mughal household. In fact, gift-giving proved the only way to be heard at court. The more opulent or bizarre the gift, the more likely you were to have an audience with the Padshah. These gifts included enslaved peoples, eunuchs, and children's toys, amongst others. Anne-Marie Schimmel maintains that these toys were one of the main fascinations of the court. The Portuguese were also extremely interested in converting Indians, violently if necessary. With Akbar's court, they chose the diplomatic approach. Missionaries were convinced that Akbar was a prime candidate for religious conversion. They felt this way because he actively sought them out and invited them to court, and he was also seen in numerous portraits holding a picture of the Virgin Mary. What these missionaries failed to realize was that Akbar was fascinated by all religions, and his portraits with the Virgin Mary are not at all unorthodox to Islam. Within Islam, the Virgin Mary is as revered a figure as she is in Christianity. Realizing they were getting nowhere fast, the Portuguese abandoned their dreams of converting the, quote, great mogul, unquote, to Christianity. The main area of operations for the Portuguese was the open ocean, where they controlled naval trade with an iron fist. The Portuguese became rich off their strangulation of Indian trade. Besides averse trade deals, the Portuguese felt it was their Christian duty to sink any and all Muslim ships carrying pilgrims bound for Mecca. To the Portuguese, all Muslims, be they Berbers, Turks, or Mughal, were Moors. They felt an ancient animosity toward Muslims, due to the hundreds of years of conflict between the two religions across the Iberian Peninsula. Pedro Alvarez Cabral was a naval commander in the area. He received orders saying, quote, "If you encounter ships belonging to the aforesaid Moors of Mecca at sea, you must endeavor as much as you can to take possession of them and of their merchandise and property, and also of the Moors who are in the ships, to your profit, as best you can, and to make war on them and do them as much damage as possible, as a people with whom we have so great and so ancient an enmity," unquote. Unsurprisingly, the despicable treatment of Mughals who were headed toward Mecca alienated many against the, quote, treacherous Portuguese, unquote. The Mughals increasingly turned to the English, who proved much more accommodating when it came to burying religious prejudices. This allowed the English to slowly begin supplanting the Portuguese as the main foreign power present at the Mughal court. Regardless, Mughal noblemen of all shades considered it, quote-unquote, beneath them to deal with these European foreigners. This left many Europeans on the outside looking in, wondering what it would take to capture the vast riches of the subcontinent. Akbar had trouble fathering children at first. Several died in infancy, causing many to worry about the royal line moving forward. By the time Akbar was 30, he still had no male heir. He sought spiritual assistance and visited numerous self-styled gurus and saints. One such guru promised him 3 sons, and when such a thing came to pass, the guru and his family were lavishly rewarded by the Mughal state. Unfortunately, the children of Akbar all suffered immensely from drug and alcohol addiction. Of his 3 sons, 2 would die before Akbar. 1 died of opium poisoning. The other was said to have wine smuggled into his chambers via a musket barrel. The alcohol cleaned the rust and iron from the inside of the musket. When Akbar's son drank this strange concoction, he died instantly. The lone survivor was Salim Jahangir, or He Who Seizes the World. Unfortunately for Akbar and countless Mughal subjects, Jahangir could at times be cruel, arbitrary, and lazy, while also being compassionate, caring, and supplicant. Jahangir rose his flag in rebellion toward the end of Akbar's life, intending on seizing the throne from his well-loved son, Khusrau. In 1603, Akbar's mother, now referred to as Mariam Makani, managed to corral her grandson back into line. In a final attempt to end the looming succession crisis, Akbar placed his own turban on the head of Jahangir, cementing him as his chosen heir. Akbar must have realized his time was drawing near. In 1605, he contracted dysentery. It was not the first time he had been afflicted, but it proved quickly to be the last. Some scholars speculate that instead of dysentery, Akbar was actually poisoned by his own son Jahangir in order to more rapidly assume the throne. In either case, Akbar was dead, and the moment he died, his empire began to fracture along sectional lines. The recently conquered Dakhani Sultanates broke free and became independent once more. Jahangir took to the field against his own son, Kamran, who had the support of a majority of the nobility. Amongst these nobles were many Rajputs, who were increasingly converting to a new religion called Sikhism, a religion which was both monotheistic and polytheistic. The founder of Sikhism, Guru Nanak, believed there was only one God, but that this God existed in all living beings, big and small, rich and poor. Because of this, all living beings needed to be treated with respect. This revolutionary religion spread rapidly throughout northwestern India. However, problems began arising when Sikh gurus began blessing certain Mughal princesses, namely Kamran. This was considered tantamount to treason by Jahangir, and he ordered the fifth guru of the Sikhs, Arjan Dev, to be executed. Unless Arjan Dev apologized and paid a fine, he would die in one of the most gruesome ways imaginable. Nihal Kaur says his murderers excavated, quote, a trench on top of a hillock, covered with iron, and started a fire beneath the platter, unquote. This heated the sand on top of the platter to excruciatingly high degrees. On May 30th, 1606, the guru was brought forward and sat on this hot plate. Nihal Kaur continues, quote, the executioner called for two guards to dig the hot sand on top of the guru's head and pour it over the rest of his body, unquote. With each new dumping of molten hot sand onto the guru's head and body, blisters exploded with blood and pus. This continued for some time, with Guru Arjan never once crying out or bemoaning his fate. When he could no longer withstand it, he asked his executioners if he could bathe in the nearby river. Entering the river, his body finally gave out, and he was sucked away with the current. The peaceful, loving, and egalitarian Sikhs were shocked that such violence would be meted out upon their leader. The new guru, Hargobind, would toss aside nonviolence and embrace the sword in order to defend his people against persecution. Sikhs were no longer depicted reading poetry or musing on the natural world. Now they appeared armed and ready for combat against any and all challengers. At the same time, Mughal hegemony was being threatened to the west, the south, and the east. In the west, the far-off Central Asian domains of the Mughals were constantly harassed by nearby nomadic tribesmen. In the south, the reinvigorated Deccani sultans confounded the Mughals in repeated campaigns. And in the east, the first British trade posts and administrative buildings were being set up around Calcutta. In the next episode, we will cover the events that define the coming era of Mughal India. The state was arguably the most opulent and powerful nation on earth for its time. In reality, the coming period would sow the seeds of destruction for an empire which was supposed to be everlasting. The inherent problems in the Mughal state would be laid bare, allowing for a truly modern political movement to take hold on the empire's periphery. This movement called for self-government for all Hindus on the subcontinent. This movement and its founder, Shivaji the Great, would inspire an entire people and begin a rebellion which would eventually annihilate the Mughal state. To hear the story of the rise of the Maratha Empire, Nur Jahan, and the fundamentalist rule of Aurangzeb, you'll have to wait for the next episode of Turning Tides. I'm your host, Joseph Pascone, and thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. Thanks for the support and thank you for listening. If you like what you've heard, we'd really appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen and share the show on social media. It really helps us to bring the show to more listeners. Thank you guys so much. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'd also like to say thank you to Movo Photo. We use their sound equipment for this podcast, as well as all of our other projects at Antics Entertainment. They make great equipment at great prices, and we really appreciate that they make content creating so accessible for indie creators like us. Check them out on social media at Movo Photo, M-O-V-O-P-H-O-T-O. Thank you again.